Chapter 7. Psychiatry and Spirituality. Early in my experience with psychiatry, I had been attracted to the psychoanalytic approach. It was my observation, however, that although many people who were emotionally handicapped improved in this approach, many others who entered it, relatively healthy, but curious about their existence and interested in investigating themselves at a deeper psychological level, did not appear profoundly changed by the treatment. Nor did they themselves believe they had undergone a significant qualitative alteration in attitude or behavior, although many did claim to have gained some personal insight. Another observation was that many analysts, instead of growing more spontaneous, human, and approachable with the development of their professional careers, became rather austere in manner, cerebral, and intellectual in meetings, and distant in social gatherings. Did this reflect certain basic limitations in the analytic approach? I came to understand these observations in this way. In our development, one can define two major processes, that of becoming more differentiated and highly defined, and that of becoming less differentiated, losing definition and organization. The first process is expressed in the incredible development of the individual human being from the fusion of two single eggs, egg and sperm meeting in the womb, to form undifferentiated cells, from which then develop organic systems, arms, legs, eyes, etc. At this early stage, the cells repeatedly divide to form a group of cells called the morula, each individual cell of which is multipotentialed, with the capability of changing into any of three basic tissue types, ectoderm, endoderm, and mesoderm. Then a fascinating organization begins to occur. At the command of some still unknown director, in which the major tissue systems begin to unfold and differentiate. This continues with greater and greater differentiation until the miracle of the completion of the physical organism, with all its diversity of functions, has been accomplished. This same process continues in the development of our emotional and mental bodies through childhood, as the early, poorly defined expression of emotions and perceptions slowly becomes more highly differentiated. We develop a fine sense of individuality and separateness from all that appears to be not us, the other. After we have left the mother's breast, we develop increasing self-sufficiency, becoming more and more able to carry on by ourselves. The second process, which perhaps can actually be called dying, is characterized by becoming more undifferentiated, losing one sense of separateness and self. This is expressed on the physical level in the deterioration of physical organs and the eventual death of the total organism itself, followed by the body's slow disintegration into dust. Although on the surface this process appears negative, I felt that it is reflected or paralleled the process I had read about in spiritual literature, that is, the breaking down of the small individual self so that one can merge into a greater universal self. It seemed related to the spiritual path one takes in order to transcend the consciousness of duality, to merge into a fundamental oneness or unity in the universe. One has to die in order to be reborn. Duality is that consciousness where everything is seen as separate and distinct unto itself, and it appears that the spiritual process attempts to break down that separateness, to supersede distinctions until one actually merges with the other and the subject-object boundary is transcended. Now, in psychoanalysis, this whole process appeared to be neglected or even contradicted. I felt that psychoanalysis was concerned with establishing the separateness of the individual as a whole entity, vital and strong, helping, in other words, to clarify the self-identity of the individual. Health was seen as rising from this more highly defined sense of individuality. Analysts contended that problems occurred in the early differentiation process if a person had failed by the age of six or so to develop a strong separate identity, whether because of conflict with parents, environmental trauma, or for whatever reason. It was the job of analysis to help one develop this finite sense of self by clearing up conflict revolving around the Oedipal stage of development, which occurs at about this age. And here was one of the first weaknesses I saw in the psychoanalytic approach. For although it was clear to me that individualization is an essential stage in healthy development, there still remains a world of evolution beyond this stage which isn't clearly defined in psychoanalytic thinking. The steps taken to increase a sense of self, separate and individual, with emphasis on mind and emotion, the very core of this small self, may be quite helpful only up to a point, but detrimental thereafter if a person is to evolve further. Many psychiatrists, and a large segment of society in general, mistakenly think that the attitudes and processes of the psychoanalytic approach, which help a person regain the health and maturity he should have attained at the age of six or seven, should be useful in continuing development throughout one's life. Here is where the danger lies. One can easily fall into the trap of overvaluing the mind and expression of emotion at the expense of morality. With the analyst curtailing his moral and value judgment, the analytic situation creates an environment of almost total permissiveness for the individual. In order for him to become aware of and to express feelings, desires, and needs which have been blocked in his emotional life, a special relationship with one's mind, thoughts, and fantasies is encouraged and promoted. This involves free association, allowing everything one thinks to come to the surface and be expressed uncensored. One becomes aware of the strong relationship of thoughts to emotions, desires, drives, and needs. Allowing this free association to occur helps bring these elements to clear consciousness, where they can be recognized and dealt with. This is one way to become better acquainted with our emotional and mental bodies. Such a process is essential in the analytic situation, but as a way of life, it can be disastrous. Yet there is ample evidence that these therapeutic principles are being carried over to society as a distorted morality, which contributes to our culturally prevalent preoccupation with self-gratification. Psychiatry may be partly responsible for this cultural borrowing and distortion of psychiatric principles by its hesitancy to relate itself to morality in its attempt to be non-judgmental, and by its failure to clearly define healthy limitations for the permissive attitude. It is clear that such boundaries must be defined. Our culture in general has gone overboard in testing how far we can go with sexuality, promiscuity, and pornography, assertiveness, aggression, and violence. There seems to me no end in sight to our testing, letting it all hang out. We're getting deeper and deeper into worshiping the senses, emotions, and our every fantasy. Instead of becoming masters of ourselves, so as to create order and facilitate humanity's evolution of consciousness, we are becoming slaves to our emotional and mental energies and being driven every which way in our craving for sensual gratification. We have deformed the land and polluted our air, food, and water. We trade insensitivity and violence with one another instead of sharing our love and giving our help where it is needed. The moral and spiritual precepts of directing our lives with discipline and a sense of responsibility, and the importance of surrendering our selfish wants and desires in order to attain higher goals for ourselves and for the welfare of others, seem to have lost importance for us. An overvaluing of emotional expression not only leads to social chaos, but absolutely curtails spiritual growth. Freedom of emotional expression must be balanced by the spiritual attitudes of giving up attachment to emotions at a certain point, as discussed later in this chapter, and of considering the possibility that our true identity may lie beyond the influence of the emotions. I believe that the psychoanalytic approach will become more balanced and holistic when integrated with spiritual principles. There is a definite need to contemporary society for such spiritual practices as quieting, emptying or controlling the mind in meditation, detaching from emotions, and disciplining and controlling our energies as expressed on the social level by developing a sense of morality, responsibility, and respect for others. Another orientation and attitude propagated by psychiatry, which I came to believe helpful up to a point and harmful beyond, was the overvaluing of the rational mind's ability to know. The faith we have that the rational mind can solve all problems, all difficulties. Although beginning to recognize the mind's limitations, for the most part, the psychoanalytic approach still gives it a preeminence among our perceptive faculties, which greatly limits any deeper awareness of reality. It seems that this overemphasis on rationality grew with the development of science and the industrial and technological revolutions. To the extent that the present state of our technology represents true and unqualified progress in civilization, we may be justified in holding the rational mind supreme. An increasingly more vocal percentage of the population, however, feels that we have had to pay too high a price in human welfare for progress that has been primarily materialistic in nature, living on the brink of nuclear war and the possibility of annihilation. Rather than indicating the infallibility of the rational mind, attests to its limitations. The psychoanalytic approach appeared to me to embody contradictions and unresolved views concerning the mind. I saw it this way. On the one hand, analysts had quickly become aware that many people do not change as a result of intellectual interpretations or didactic discussions of their problems. We can, however, gain insight into our problems through the non-rational technique of free association. It appeared that analysts recognized the importance of going beyond the rational mind in order to delve more deeply into the nature of one's existence and then to use the rational mind to help evaluate and integrate what one discovered. The analytic approach deems it crucial that the patient understand the genetic determinants of his behavior, that is, how early environmental traumas relate to present symptoms in order to effect a lasting cure. Actually, there is growing doubt among psychotherapists that the rational mind even needs to evaluate and integrate what one uncovers in order for healing to take place. In other words, one does not necessarily have to know how his problem is related to early parental or environmental experience to find relief from his symptom. There are psychotherapies being developed now in which the full therapeutic work is done non-verbally, and no attempt is made to explain the whys or wherefores. Success rates in these psychotherapies seem at least as good as those reported for psychoanalytic therapy. Could it be that the healing force in all the therapies has more to do with love and human caring than the cerebrating intellectual gyrations, which mean very little? At any rate, analysts seemed, on the one hand, to have recognized sufficient limitations of the rational mind in the treatment process to develop the technique of free association. On the other hand, I was struck by how cerebral and overly intellectual many analysts were in their writings and in meetings, as if they actually thought they could understand and define human nature with concepts and mechanisms as one would an automobile. Even early in my education, I had greatly doubted that one could understand human nature in this manner. But many analysts gave it a good try, and I still remember how boring it was for me to wade through reams of arid professional reading material. I found myself instead reading about mystics, Zen Buddhism, and other spiritual doctrines in which is found again and again the firm association that higher levels of reality simply can't be comprehended by the mind, in which the mind is considered as an obstacle to be overcome and transcended in order for one to see more deeply into his true nature. Identifying with mind, emotions, or body leads one more deeply into the world of illusion, into the condition of suffering. I felt that the Western behavioral scientists' identification of self with mind was the result of a one-sided vision of reality. My attraction to such spiritual concepts as Atma, the real self, one's divinity, imperishable, immutable, infinite, eternal, and Moksha, the emergence of the wave with the ocean from which it appears to differ, liberation from delusion, release from the round of birth and death, the attainment of eternal joy, was simply too great to allow me to be bound by the limited conceptions of self adhered to in modern psychiatry. These Eastern views and the spiritual practices growing out of them demanded thorough investigation. A comparison of the psychoanalytic process of free association with the practice of Eastern-originated meditation points out in a concrete way the differences between East and West in attitudes and approaches toward mind and self. The aim of both these processes is toward realizing our deepest inner nature, and the central element in each is our becoming aware of being an observer and witness, but for different reasons. In free association, one becomes the observer as a means to an end, in order to watch thoughts and emotions as they bubble up into awareness. The assumption is that these thoughts and feelings are valuable because they eventually lead to underlying conflicts which, when found, can be resolved. Therefore, one is directed to attend to and follow them. In meditation, on the other hand, simply being aware of oneself as witness may be an end in itself. The experience of being centered or focused in full awareness in the here and now may lead us into deeper experience of our true nature. Meditation is supposed to take us beyond the mind to the point where we can watch passing thoughts and feelings without being seduced into attending to and following them. If the mind is to be used at all, it is to be directed by the will of the observer to create an inner spiritual experience, such as that which invokes a sense of awe of creation, or an all-encompassing sense of love and peace. This can be done by mentally repeating one of the many names of God, trying to visualize light, picturing a form of worship, or any number of techniques. These exercises tend to tame the mind, encouraging in one the experience of divinity believed to lie at the center of our identity. By staying in touch with oneself as witness and with an aspect of the divine, one may eventually reach the place where witnesser and the witnessed, the I and the that, merge and become one. At this point, the profound sense of the great Eastern phrase Tat Tvam Asi, that thou art, may be finally realized, and one enters the peace and calm that defies understanding. By contrast, if one is free associating on an analyst's couch and drops into a place of great peace and quiet, this may be interpreted as resistance to the flow of material, and the individual may be encouraged back into following his thoughts and feelings. In Eastern thought, concerning the nature of man, there is a clear distinction made between mind and real self, a distinction not appreciated in contemporary psychiatry. Baba has said, quote, "The scientist looks outside and is always saying, 'What is this?'" End quote. This, which can be perceived by the senses, existing in the world of emotion or mind. Baba's quotation continues, "But the saint is always looking inside, and his question is, 'What is that?'" End quote. That which is beyond the senses, beyond emotions, beyond the grasp of the mind. Baba says, quote, "The mind is like a cloth, the threads of which are desire. If we give up desire, the cloth falls away, revealing our true nature." End quote. My most serious misgiving about psychoanalysis arose when I witnessed what happened within myself during early attempts at treating patients with this approach. I began feeling less spontaneous, more controlled and isolated from my patients, the exact opposite of the results I had hoped for. I began to search for a way of observing and reacting to the world which was less limiting. This led me to Gestalt therapy, a method I found both interesting and promising. I launched an enthusiastic investigation by undertaking the therapy myself. On the positive side, this approach dealt more directly with the nature of duality and the possibility of going beyond it, and therefore seemed to recognize at least the possibility of man's spiritual nature. There was also less emphasis on the rational mind as a means of gaining deeper knowledge of the world, and more on one's taking responsibility himself for his actions without blaming mother, father, or early trauma. Still, as in most uncovering insight-oriented psychotherapies, great value is placed on freedom of expression without defining or even raising the issue of where in one's development detachment from emotions becomes desirable or necessary. The Gestalt therapist is less concerned than the psychoanalyst with the whys behind a patient's behavior. This, he feels, only leads to overly intellectual talk about problems instead of direct experience of them. His job is to help the patient directly experience, thereby becoming aware of what he is doing and how he is being in the here and now. Being centered in this kind of awareness without being unduly limited or constricted by memories of the past, worries about the future, transient emotions, or repetitious and distracting thought patterns, is considered growth-promoting. This seemed to me a rather great change in orientation from analytic therapy. Interpretation and explanation by the therapist was considered a waste of time, serving only to boost the ego of the therapist. His job, then, became less cerebral as he stopped trying to figure the patient out, and more spontaneous intuitive as he tried to experience the patient's reality. Gestalt therapists indeed looked different from analysts, seeming to reflect their different orientations to the world. The generally austere, well-tailored, at times up-in-the-air analyst was a contrast to the frequently more spontaneous, sometimes overly casual, but more down-to-earth Gestalt therapist. Gestalt practitioners frequently wanted to be called by their first name. The founder of the movement, Fritz Perls, projected an image of earthy, cantankerous playfulness, sometimes even to the extent of jarring coarseness. At times, he wore a jumpsuit and always casual clothing. He wrote a book with the scholarly title, In and Out of the Garbage Pail. This sort of flavor about the therapist and therapy was quite attractive to me. The patient in Gestalt therapy is asked to move beyond duality and break the subject-object boundary to re-identify with avoided or projected aspects of self by actually becoming any object or feeling state avoided or considered separate and apart from the self, often by acting out the role of the object or feeling, or attempting to develop a dialogue with it. Everything perceived by the senses or conceived by the mind as being separate from the self is considered a projection of the self, an aspect of the self which for some reason the self considers foreign and tries to cut off and reject. Frequently, the work of the treatment is to direct the patient to re-identify with this shunned aspect, making better contact with it or even merging with it and regaining the energy bound up in the projection process. Of particular significance are those projections labeled bad, or those which are in any way avoided or considered particularly alien to the self, and an effort is made to establish channels to these areas so as to end struggling with them. For example, if one is phobic or frightened of barking dogs, he may be asked to play the part of a barking dog. If he is frightened of anger, violence, or spontaneous assertive behavior, he may initially find it difficult to be the barking dog. As his reluctance breaks down, and he feels more familiar with his task, he may likewise feel more at home with his own impulses and his own assertiveness. What was once a frightening experience may now turn into a source of strength. In this way, one may develop the capacity to assert himself when that reaction is called for in everyday life. It often happens that by playing this kind of game, the patient becomes aware that such projections have become symbols, and that something important lies hidden within the symbol, something avoided and feared. When one re-identifies and rediscovers those parts of himself which are avoided because of fears or guilts, he becomes stronger and healthier. Using the previous example, if one is frightened of anger, acting out the emotions and feelings of the barking dog, although at first frightening, may become a source of pleasure and strength as one gains experience with such activity and sees that nothing terrible comes of it. In this process, as one reestablishes contact with repressed feelings, including them among the choice of responses he has in facing the world, he no longer has to avoid or be frightened of all situations in which a possible appropriate choice of activity is anger or aggression. Through such treatment, I became more deeply aware of the nature of duality, more familiar with some of the techniques that could be used to break down the subject-object boundary. I found usefulness in the techniques, but after a while, I found some limitations as well. For instance, in my own experience, these techniques did not resolve my fears of death or of physical or mental deterioration with age. I could not get to that state where I was unaffected by such fears. I could not lessen my aversion for weakness. I wanted to feel strong and in control and did not want to feel weak and helpless. No matter how many times I played these roles, I still ended up wanting one over the other, continuing to fear weakness and struggling to be strong. Although aware of my areas of avoidance, in trying to resolve them, I frequently found myself playing parts over and over again without making any headway. There finally came a time when I felt I could go no further in Gestalt therapy. I was unable to break the certain problem cycles and saw myself endlessly repeating certain patterns of behavior and responses without knowing how to get out. Even though I began to appreciate that what I considered the outside world was really me, and that struggling with it was only a reflection of my struggle with myself, that if I wanted to stop my inner struggle, I would have to stop wrestling with the outside, I was still unable to stop. It was as if I were stuck in the groove of a record, repeating myself over and over again. The only way of getting out would be to pick myself up out of the groove and place myself somewhere else. The difficulty and confusion in the therapy seemed to be that in order to break the cycle, one had to become unaffected by real pain and the feelings and emotions which accompany it. Psychotherapy may be effective in overcoming an irrational or imagined fear in which one fears a situation that in reality is not painful, but it is quite another thing not to fear a situation which really is painful. To become unaffected by and detached from real emotions is generally considered a negative and undesirable process by most schools of psychotherapy. They generally call such a maneuver a defense against or denial of reality. On the other hand, this kind of detached attitude toward what we call the real or physical world is an indispensable part of the spiritual approach. This is a point over which psychiatry has been so critical of religion. Most psychotherapies believe that one of the basic principles behind motivation is that of pleasure-pain. Because of our experience of either pleasure or pain, we develop the desire to choose one object over another, our seeing things as separate from one another, and of being more or less valuable is directly related to our anticipation of pleasure or pain. Gratification of wants is pleasurable. Frustration of wants is painful. If there were a way to transcend this whole system so that one could be unaffected by either pleasure or pain, then everything would be considered equal. The pressure to move in one direction rather than another would end, as all directions would be the same. Duality, the experience of seeing things separate and apart, would then have been transcended. Psychiatry's position is that to try to become unaffected by such a central system in our lives is, in fact, a defensive measure, a way of trying to repress or deny our true identity. Psychiatrists, for the most part, do not believe that there is a higher self or a level of consciousness beyond duality. Their position is that God is manufactured by man. Belief in a higher self is a defense against emotions. On the other hand is the spiritual attitude. Attachment to the emotions is a defense against realizing one's higher self. It became apparent to me that at one level of our development, the process of becoming more differentiated and developing a sense of self, it is very important to become aware of emotions and to learn to express them. It is important to be able to feel both the role of the weak and of the strong, to feel all the reactions involved in living both roles, and to know how to express the full repertoire of feelings related to each. But at another level of development, the process of dying or dissolving the small self in order to merge into a higher self, it is essential to learn to detach from emotions and the senses, to learn not to desire strength over weakness, pleasure over pain, or even life over death, to treat all positions as equal. Such seemingly opposed feelings are an illusion. They reflect a dualistic perception of being in the universe. One of the reasons for psychiatry's failure to integrate or reconcile these two fundamental approaches to human growth seems to be a general misunderstanding of the nature of detachment, a confusion of detachment with repression. There is a great difference between the two. My belief is that at the point in our development when we are trying to become more individual and defined, it may be harmful to detach from the emotions. To do so then would be to repress primary energies at a time when we are just learning about them. It would be like giving up walking before one has learned how to walk. We would become emotionally crippled. One cannot transcend the senses or emotions, cannot surrender them to God, if one is not actually in control of them, if one has not first reached a stage of individuality. They are not ours to surrender. In effect, we grow toward emerging with the universal or cosmic self up through the human self, a vehicle for growth like the stem of a plant. And since the human or small self is as much mental and emotional as it is physical, a strong sense of identity and integration of the emotions are as important in our development as is the stem's cellular growth. After we have attained a state of individuality and identity, it is time to surrender the ego or personality of the small self in order to merge into the higher self, to give up involvement with the senses in favor of a deeper involvement with God, to transfer our energy from stem making and maintenance to blossoming. In talking about the process of growth and the final stage of release, Sai Baba has said, quote, "It is like the flower of one's individuality growing into a fruit and filling itself with sweet juice out of its own inner essence, and then the final release from the tree." End quote. This seems to be the difference then between repression and detachment. The first is separating oneself out of fear from contact with one's senses and emotions before learning to control and harness these energies, thereby remaining unaware of them. The second is surrendering them willingly as part of our yearning to continue to grow after we have gained awareness and a measure of self-mastery of them. Religion presents many techniques, orientations, and attitudes toward life which help in gaining detachment from feelings. But for most psychiatrists, this is regarded as detrimental to emotional stability and sound mental health. The common Western attitude regarding this kind of detachment is that it is a defense against our basic drives and emotions, and as a consequence, likely to foster indifference toward human welfare and a selfish withdrawal from society. The spiritually wise say this is not the case. They point to examples of the highest expression of the correct spiritual attitudes as demonstrated in the lifestyle, character, and activities of such greats as Christ, Krishna, and Buddha, and they assert that, in fact, one becomes more loving, creative, and productive to the degree that he is able to be in the world while remaining fundamentally unaffected by it. So the question arose, how to break out of the hold of duality? And was it possible to do so without giving up one's attachment to his senses and feelings? This chapter ends with two quotations from Satya Sai Baba. First, it is enough if love is cultivated, the love that knows no distinction between oneself and another, because all are but limbs of the one corpus of God Almighty. Through love alone can the embodiment of love be gained. Here no scholarship is needed. In fact, scholarship will be an impediment, for it caters to egoism, and it breeds doubts, and the desire for disputation, and the laurel of victory over others, preening themselves as learned. Second quotation. You must not be a bit of blotting paper, absorbing all the passions and emotions, all the joys and griefs that the actress nature demonstrates on the stage of life. You must be a lotus, unfolding its petals when the sun rises in the sky, unaffected by the slush where it is born, or even the water which sustains it. End quotation.